Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. Today's guest is the co-founder of Tyrus Books, a small publishing house based in Madison, Wisconsin, that counts New York Times bestselling author Reed Farrell Coleman and Barnes & Noble Discover Award winner Scott O'Connor among their notable roster of authors. Please welcome Ben Leroy to the show.
Hey, Harry. Glad to be here.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for coming on. You started Tyrus Books in 2009 with Allison Dasho after the two of you left crime publisher Bleak House, which you also started back in 2001. Why leave one publisher you had started to found another?
Awesome question. Back in 2001, we started Bleak House, started publishing stuff in the early 2002, 2003. And by about 2005, we were running out of funds and it was getting a little bit dire, and a larger publishing company, Big Earth Publishing, saw us at Book Expo America, liked what we were doing, and asked if we would want to sell, and said that that would mean that we could continue to work for Bleak House and that we would get a paycheck and health insurance, two things that we were not getting, and that we would then be able to keep doing what we were doing, have the capital to do it correctly, and be able to make a living doing it. Then that lasted from 2005 to 2009. We got into a disagreement with the management at Big Earth. It was along the dividing line of they wanted to go to digital only all the time, just ebooks only. And I still believe then and believe now in the viability of print as a form of how people want to read books. Mm-hmm. Allison and I left to start Tyrus. Well, so then from 2009 to 2011, we had a few small investors and people who were helping out that way. And then in 2011, sold the company to F&W Media, where again, the paycheck and health insurance and the capital to do things correctly was an opportunity to continue to grow the company. Allison moved to Seattle and she works now as an editor at Amazon, but that is the short story version of the last 15 years or so.
So you started Tyrus 2 years after the housing economy crashed and the recession began. What was it like starting up a new venture, especially an independent publisher, not only in the middle of a recession, but also at the same time as the Kindle was skyrocketing in popularity and news outlets everywhere were bemoaning the death of the publishing industry?
It was scary as hell, to be honest. And I think that there's probably a mixture of idealism and youth that really got me through that time period, because it was scary. And finding people who had the disposable cash around to invest in a small publishing company, I was doing everything in my personal life on credit cards, racking up all kinds of debt, had no health insurance. There was definitely this, I'm going to jump from cliff A to cliff B, and there is no room for error. And somehow I made it to cliff B, but it was scary. And there were a lot of times that we spoke to potential investors who had a lot of concerns about, is print going to be viable? How do we get in on the ebook side of things? How do you make money in ebooks? The pricing of ebooks was a concern as far as making margins and being able to generate enough revenue to sustain a business. It was scary, but somehow, through good fortune, I guess, made it to the other side.
It's been almost 10 years since the Kindle really took off, and self-publishing and ebook publishing has really taken off. And it doesn't seem like a lot of that's been fixed yet. You know, pricing is still a nebulous area for a lot of publishers. You know, too low and you're not making any money, too high and no one's buying your book.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think that part of that is when the era of when that was born, there was so much disruption going on, not just in the publishing industry, but as you mentioned, the economy in general. And some of what was set as the normals at the time wasn't based in any sort of scientific research or any sort of great economics discipline study. It was well, 99 cents is something that will sell a book, so let's just use that. And then if anyone else is charging more than 99 cents, they're clearly corrupt, and old legacy publishing is traditional publishing is dead and outdated. And there were a lot of people talking who did not have complete pictures of how books get made. And you are talking in some ways about apples and oranges, or at least different strains of apples, mm-hmm. when you're talking about somebody self-publishing and the expenses that go into that versus somebody who is publishing in a different way that has more overhead. And I can see an argument for, I want to get books out as fast as possible and I want to get books out as cheap as possible, but that doesn't always give the best shot of success. And that's an important consideration when figuring out pricing and how to do things, which of course is not to say that big publishing has some magical formula to make every book a success, because we know that that's not the case. And it's not a suggestion that big publishing doesn't have lots of room for learning and figuring new things out, because this is still a changing dynamic, and there are a lot of people who would sell you on the idea that social media is the key to selling a million books. And it's all digital witchcraft, and it's just a matter of figuring out which particular brew works best in each particular situation. And there's no guarantees that anyone ever really gets that right.
I mean, you could argue there's more of a risk of not being a success with a larger publisher, simply because if you're not a James Patterson or a Stephen King or one of the top names, then you're not getting the full support of a large publisher. And I don't know. Do you agree? Do you feel there's more flexibility with a smaller publisher in terms of marketing and you know, a force behind a book?
Yeah, it's just really difficult calculus, because having the necessary capital to do things, to pay for things, but also having the necessary connections to reviewers, to bookstore mm-hmm. people. Once you start talking about the print component and you're looking to have reviews in, say, the New York Times, or you're looking to be on the shelf of an independent bookstore or Barnes & Noble, all of those things require behind-the-scenes machinery and processes that are not available to smaller publishers or self-published authors in the same way. And certainly the James Pattersons, the Michael Conleys, the John Grishams get more attention front of the bookstore placement, co-op dollars spent that way. But those things also support, maybe not as much as they did 30 or 40 years ago, but support the midlist and support the chance for debut authors, because when they make a lot of money, there's more money at the publishing house to do different things and to experiment and try things. And again, I mean, it's on a day-to-day basis, who knows how much of that James Patterson money is going into unknown author debut, but it's definitely part of the equation.
Are awards important to small publishers? Do they help visibility and growth?
This is one of those things that I hate to report, but in a lifetime of publishing, and for what it's worth, most of my publishing time has been spent in the crime fiction arena. All but the most prestigious awards have no discernible effect on sales. What it does for visibility and all of those things, I can't even begin to guess. But I do know that there have only been two awards that I can ever remember the company either being a finalist for or winning that I've seen an actual uptick in sales. Everything else has just been a nice affirmation. It feels nice to be validated for what mm-hmm. you're doing. But as far as selling books, which is of course what keeps things going, that I haven't seen a one-to-one correlation.
Yeah, the only awards I really know of are the Hugo, the Man Booker, and the Pulitzer. And what results with those are, you know, the NPR tours and the talk show circuit and all that. So you get shortlisted, or if you win, you end up on those, and that will help boost your visibility, I think.
Sure, and those are all, I think, the Hugo's on the same level as the Edgar Award in the crime fiction world, mm-hmm. and we, back in 2008, had three books that were finalists for Edgar Awards. And that was the only time, that was back in the Bleak House days, that was the only time a small press had done that. And we had a finalist for Best Short Story, Best First Novel, and Best Novel. And the only one that had an actual uptick in sales was the Best Novel. There was, you could actually look on BookScan and see a spike in sales after that had been announced. And then the other one that clearly, and it's obviously a no-brainer, that had a large effect on sales was the Discover Award, which was given by Barnes & Noble. And that's because when our book, Untouchable, by Scott O'Connor, won the Discover Award, it was prominently displayed at every Barnes & Noble, and Barnes & Noble had a vested interest in pushing and selling the book, right, and did a good job of doing that.
Wow. So was there anything you had taken with you from starting Bleak House when you went to go start Tyrus? Anything you had learned?
Sure. There are so many things that, again, are sort of behind the scenes about how to make books sell. And the things that I took from Bleak House that I think were most important were a lot of authors came with us from Bleak House to Tyrus. And that was critical because we had built our identity working with a core group of authors. And it helped to be able to say, Allison and Ben are still publishing the same authors. It's just a different name on the spine. And that was easier for us to go to places like Publishers Weekly or Booklist and say, okay, you know who we are, you know what we do. And then we were also able to take our relationships with bookstores and do the same thing. And it really has become a matter of finding, developing, nurturing, and maintaining relationships with media, with booksellers. And those are all things that we were able to do from Bleak House to Tyrus in that transition.
How big has Tyrus Books gotten since it first started?
The first season, we did three books, I think. Or I'm still kind of keeping it pretty simple at somewhere between 10 to 12 books a year. Just because for right now, I am the entire staff of Tyrus for as far as the editing and the acquisition of the editing. And I am able to work with some of my coworkers at F&W who help provide publicity support and sales support and some other things. But
in terms of getting the books out, it's you, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's me. And when I first made the move from owning Tyrus to selling Tyrus to F&W, I was able to also acquire a lot of the old Bleak House backlist titles as ebooks because the old Bleak House contracts didn't have any kind of clause about ebooks. So I was able to go back and get a lot of the old authors that I had been working with. And then as a side project, I was also working with a couple of people to acquire the ebook rights to crime, sci-fi, and Western books that had been published in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and in some cases the 70s that had gone out of print and that nobody had brought into ebook format, had never actually worked with the estates of the authors or with the authors directly. So that was a separate line called Prologue Books, and got about 500 titles for Prologue in the first year or so of working with F&W. So there was a big acquisition period just because I was getting the old backlist of Bleak House stuff and all the Prologue stuff in those first 12 to 18 months of working with F&W. And then since then, it's been about 10 books a year.
How important is the backlist to Tyrus or Prologue's bottom line?
I think it's pretty important, especially when we have series that are popular, because if you can get somebody interested in one installment in the series and then those readers enjoy it and go back and buy the other ones, it's a chance to make some of those authors into really lead horses. One of the best-selling authors that we have is a woman named Victoria Houston, and we just released the 16th book in her series, and we have books 1 through 16. And it's definitely important because we might do a BookBub deal for her newest book. And then when people find that and enjoy it and read that, they'll go back and buy up all of the backlist. And that has been a great revenue generator.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's NACHTSound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. I do want to talk. You had mentioned your love of paper and what happened with Bleak House and
Big Earth.
Yeah. And Big Earth and the move to digital. In an interview on sarahweinman.com from 2009, you had said, quote, "As a student of the publishing industry, I can't help but know that the ebook market is growing and that it must be acknowledged. As a lover of the printed book, I will continue to fight like hell for the paper artifact. Like our time at Bleak House, we're very committed to making books that are not only good reads, but aesthetically pleasing." How has publishing changed in the last 7 years with regard to digital versus print?
Back at that point, I think there was a common prevailing wisdom in some circles that ebooks were going to come, they were going to spike and stay spiked, and that print was going to have the corollary downward spike, and that we would no longer be living in a paper world. Mm-hmm. And that fear, for lack of a better term, I think was overblown. We did see ebooks come in and take a considerable section of the market, but we did also see that plateau and level out, and that print didn't die the agonizing, screaming death that some people thought it might, and that there was a chance for once things settled, once people got used to the different technologies and the different way of reading books, there was, in many cases, open conversation where people said, you know what, I prefer paper. I like the smell of a book. I like the feel of a book. There are things about the printed book that I like, mm-hmm. that people who have more analog sensibilities maybe, but that is to say that readers, as it turns out, have different preferences and choices. And there are people who will never probably read another printed book again because the portability, the speed, all of those things associated with reading an ebook, that's all wonderful. And that works exactly for their preferences and what they love. And then, of course, there are still the remaining print books, and that those work for other people. And there are people who do a mix. And at the time, because the economy was crashing and because publishing was having this parallel change, this upheaval, nobody knew and everyone was screaming. And a lot of people were screaming out street corner style prophecies of this is all going to end in horrible, horrible things. And it was really a matter of let's just wait this out and let's just see what shakes out and let's not be afraid. And let's always remember that the most important thing is that people turn to books and story because they want to feel less alone and they want to feel a part of the world around them. So let's just make sure that we continue to produce books that do exactly that. And that is, I think, what was going on. And it was hard in those days to be able to have a long-term view of things because everything felt so immediate. It was also a presidential election. It was a major presidential election in 2008, too. So there was just all of this chaos going on compared to now where everything is calm, everything is peaceful, nothing is going on in the world.
Everyone is on their best behavior,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So since outside of the digital versus print part of it, what have you seen? Have you seen drastic changes in the publishing industry?
Not as drastic as maybe I would like. and I don't even know that I know exactly what that means. I think that there is an overrepresentation of particular types of stories and that those overrepresentations come from the geographical and other demographical realities of the people who are making those choices. And there is part of me that wants to really understand how it is that what we see on the shelf is there and how we can change that without ever sacrificing the quality of writing or of story. For me, one of my big issues, and I know that there are different camps divided in this discussion along, like I said, all of the different demographical things. And I think all of those are obviously legitimate and there's merit to all of those conversations and we should continue to have them. And Daniel Jose Older and I did on my podcast, we discussed a bunch of that stuff. But for me, it's hard not to notice that there are particular academic filters into the publishing world, that there are channels that people are able to swim from certain universities and colleges into publishing, and that geographically, a lot of the publishers who are putting out the things that are being discussed are east of the Hudson River or mm-hmm. very close to the Hudson River. And I live life in the Midwest, and I went to a state university, and I have friends and acquaintances and work experiences with people who are, I know billionaires, and I also know people who are in prison or that I used to work with who were on work release during the day. And there's a lot to be gained from the stories of some people, but their stories probably don't appeal or relate to people who are making decisions about what to acquire. And that is one thing that has not changed as fast as I would like it to in publishing. And I'm in no position to really do much about it, but if I were going to change, that would be one of the things. And I don't have an easy answer because it's not simply a matter of, oh, well, here's this person who's never going to get a book deal, hand them a pen and a sheet of paper and let them write a story. Like, it's not that, because there are considerations for the art and there are considerations for how a book works. And that's all part of this very complicated assessment of where we are, how we're here, what can change, how we change it. And as you mentioned, even though we're all on our best behavior right now, it's hard to find answers for a lot of questions.
Yeah.
There's consensus on things need to change, but then there's less consensus on how things need to change. And you have legitimate arguments from multiple points of view that directly contradict each other. There's a Greek psychological state called aporia, where you get directly opposite conclusions from the same data points, and both of them are legitimately true. You can make yourself believe either one is true, even though they are the exact opposite. And that is a paralyzing construct for making decisions and moving forward when you have people who have, we all have access to the same data and we just have radically different solutions for how things change.
Right. You have one side saying the data shows that there are not enough diverse authors out there, but at the same time, that same data shows there aren't enough people buying books by diverse authors.
Right.
And so, yeah, you have this conundrum, this catch-22 of, well, if we put more diverse authors out there, will they sell books? And, you know, the big publishers are probably less willing to take that chance, it seems like, from the conversations I've seen. And maybe there's room for independent publishers and smaller publishers to come in and give those voices a chance to be heard.
That is certainly the beauty of the independent house, is the not having to go through 50 layers of acquiring a book. You don't have to run it through the marketing department. You don't have to run it through 10 different people who have perhaps very different takes on why a book should be published or how a book sells. You can be flexible. Now, of course, you can be flexible and you can move fast and still fail like a mother. but that's just part of the gamble and the risk. And I would hope that at the base of it all, it's people acquiring and editing and publishing books that they love and that they feel add value to the literary landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is Tyrus doing? Is Tyrus doing anything to help give voice to those writers out there who might not be able to sign with a larger publisher?
Sure. If you go back and you look through our catalog, I'd like to think that it's got a wide range of sensibilities. I kind of look at it, the whole catalog of From Bleak House to Tyrus, and I think that there's a fairly wide range. But I'm also, you know, publishing, my North Star is my Midwestern upbringing, really. Mm-hmm. And so it's what appeals to me and what makes sense and what I can relate to and see the urgency of the story, given my experiences in life. And there have been, you know, there are authors that I've published that I'm very proud of, that those two, there can be two authors who have radically different stories and wouldn't maybe even like each other as human beings, but I can understand the value in both of their stories and both of the books that they've written. So I specifically try to avoid more vanilla, by the numbers, assembly line, re-scripted television plots. So if I see something and I say, okay, that's just an episode of 24 stretched out into book form. Mm-hmm. And I walk away from that, because I say, this, it may be entertaining and it may sell a million copies and people, you know, may love it and God bless them for it, but it doesn't speak to me. It doesn't register with me. It doesn't resonate with me. And I just try to not be a part of putting out things that I say, there's already 50 of this in the marketplace coming out this week, and here's one more. I try to avoid being a part of that.
Knowing that you're the head of the house, so to speak, mm-hmm. you're the one making these decisions, do you worry that your decisions are indicative of a kind of bias? Do you worry about only publishing certain kinds of books, not just in a certain genre, but certain kinds of books within that genre, that you might be missing out on maybe bigger books or books that you didn't think or know would have tickled a different fancy, so to speak?
Sure. That is a great question, and I think one that anyone in any position of acquisition should be asking of themselves. I'm sure I would be a fool to pretend that I don't have biases that are intrinsic to who I am, and that mm-hmm. there are probably blind spots where I don't even see particular biases. I have to also work with the following restrictions. One, before I can publish anything, and this is part of being a part of a larger corporation, I have to take a book into a meeting where I present it to my boss, the publicity department, and the sales department. And I have to be able to show how this book is going to get out to a wide audience. And it doesn't even matter at that point how much I love the book. I have to be able to show how this book is going to find an audience, coupled with our efforts, but how the book itself or the author are going to help ensure an audience. I also have to work with what is submitted to me. I don't have time to go out and seek, and it, like we talked about before, I'm kind of the only guy. So what I have to work with is what is sent to me by authors or by agents. And there may be many, many people who don't even know that Tyrus Books exists, so they're not submitting. And the agents who are submitting books to us, and we get projects from all of the major agencies and boutique agencies and agents just starting up, so I get a wide range of agents, but I get their projects that they have associated with me for the last 15 years. So I don't even know what I'm not seeing from those agents, no matter how many times I say, okay, cool that you're sending me this crime novel, but please know that I'm also interested in, and I'll have those conversations with agents. So I'm working with what I can get approved and what is coming in, either through agents or through authors. And then what of all of that do I think is going to sell and is something that I think I can be proud of, add to, edit. And there are things, there are books that we've put out that I would, if I sometimes use the analogy that if I had to, when I die, right before I die, I have to rank everything as far as my favorites of what I've published, that some of the books that would be at the very top of the list of the things that I love the most have absolutely dismal sales history. It did not translate. My love and passion for something did not translate into great sales. And conversely, there are things where I said, well, you know, I like this and I get this and I think this has a market. It's not me as a reader, but I think this has a market. I have published those things and they have done well. And so I try to check my biases there. And then you have to ask a question of, do I not like this? Or am I not liking this is the wrong way of phrasing that. Am I not as passionate about this because it's not a good book or because it just doesn't speak to me? And you definitely have to draw those lines and you definitely have to understand what is the universal core of the book that is going to appeal to readers. How do you accentuate that? And how do you focus on getting that to be the way that you look at it and say, yes, I can publish this. I can publish this because I see the core of this and it's not speaking to me, but the light in the middle of it is shining bright enough that I see it.
Yeah. And I don't know how I feel about it, but it, I guess you see it more with the big publishers because they have to justify every decision they make when taking on a book that they might take a loss on. But there is that separation of art and business that is, as much as you love something, you may love a book more than anything, it still does come down to a meeting with your boss and can we sell this book? And you might actually have it harder than your average large publisher. You know, there was that story that 50 Shades of Grey paid for all the other little books that they published that year, all those smaller debut novels, because of how much it had brought in. But with every book you take on, you say you only publish 12 a year, you're probably publishing 12 out of how many hundreds of submissions you get.
Exactly. It's multiple hundreds of submissions that we get. And I try to also be as very specific as possible on our submission guidelines about what we're not looking for. So I would like to think that what is getting submitted to us is curated before it even gets through the gates.
Right.
And that there are 1,000 queries that weren't sent in just because I'm so hyper specific about I don't want this, I don't want this, I don't want this. But yeah, it's tough. And a lot of it is about missed connections and missed opportunities. And as much as people might say, well, you didn't publish this book, it's like, okay, well, no one ever talked to me about that book. No one ever brought that book to my attention. No one. And you could say, okay, well, why aren't you out searching for it? But it's because from 7 to 8 o'clock, you know, 7 in the morning until 8 o'clock at night, I've got my hands full doing other things. I don't have the luxury of digging through online journals or other places where authors might be hanging out. It's all about communication. And you hope, you put up a shingle and you hope that people knock on the door.
FeedPress is made for bloggers and podcasters. FeedPress is a simple, intuitive, and powerful RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform. Featuring accurate subscriber, podcast download, and geolocation tracking, integrated newsletters, automated publishing to popular social networks such as Twitter and Facebook, a slick drag-and-drop podcast hosting interface, and everything you need in order to submit an optimized feed to iTunes. Now featuring 400 megabytes of flexible file storage that rolls over monthly, and a new podcast post-creation system you can easily add show notes, artwork, and upload 4 high-quality bitrate MP3s per month. Upgrading storage is easy and affordable, starting at a flat rate of just $20 for 1 gigabyte. FeedPress offers an automatic migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Answer a few simple questions and the rest is taken care of. Your feeds and subscriber data will be transitioned into your FeedPress account, leaving you free to focus on what you do best, make content. FeedPress offers free migration assistance and will take care of the hard work for you. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via email. Get in touch and they can help. Feed Press is trusted by many popular blogs and podcasting networks such as Good Stuff FM, Electric Shadow Network, Sideshow Network, Unprofessional, The New Disruptors, Inessential, The Brooks Review, 512 Pixels, and of course, Covered. Sign up today and try Feed Press on a 14-day trial. No contracts, no commitments. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. In the vein of this topic, there was a little over a week ago, author Adam Silvera had tweeted a long thread about signing with a small publisher and how when he did it, he was met with derision and pity from other writers and even his family members when they announced the news. And even authors who self-publish a bad book can be viewed more favorably than authors who opt to sign with a smaller or independent publisher. Why do you think small and independent publishers are viewed unfavorably when compared with the other ways you can publish a book? You know, why do you think you're not seeing as much as you could be seeing, and not just because of the submission guidelines?
I'm going to get a little wonky on this one.
Okay, I like wonky.
All right. Part of the problem is that what we mean when we say small press, small publisher, or in the vernacular of a decade ago, an independent publisher, which is to be understood differently than when someone says they're an indie author, mm-hmm. is that the definition for small publisher means so many different things to so many people. And that is a micro press that somebody is running out of their garage. And it is companies making multi-millions of dollars. Those are still technically small presses. And the idea that you just lump all companies that aren't one of the big five into the small press bucket is short-sighted and uninformed. And it's frustrating, although it's a battle that I've sort of ceased fighting, just because every time you have this conversation in one place, it pops up in 10 other places and you can't be everywhere to say, okay, but here's the thing. Soho is a small press, as is this really, really tiny thing that you've never heard of. One has books landing on the New York Times bestseller list and getting reviewed in the New York Times and being featured everywhere. And one is something that's going to live and die in full obscurity. And we call both of those things a small press. So when people have the impression that small press means what is represented by the guy in his basement who's putting out one book a year, and that's what we understand to mean small press, of course our friends and our family are going to look at us and be like, oh, you've failed somehow, because look, there's only this one small operation that's giving you any consideration. There are small presses that have staffs of 20, 30, 50 people, and those are still technically small presses.
Right.
And I think that that distinction is a really important one, and that language matters, especially in the publishing world. At some point, indie publishing went from being talking about independent publishers to people self-publishing on Kindle or wherever else. And that's a trip to me, because all of a sudden people started talking about indie publishers, and I was like, no, you're just one person putting something out on, you know, on Kindle. Mm-hmm. That's not what we mean by independent publisher. And that term, for whatever reason, got co-opted to mean something entirely different about somewhere in the last decade. And how do you keep up with that? The fluidity of language and definitions, and how do you inform people that, oh, what you mean when you say that is not what that word actually means, and it means something different to me. So when people celebrate, like, oh, I self-published this book, and I've been, you know, I chose to self-publish this book, and people clap and celebrate that, that's great. I mean, I applaud that enthusiasm, and I have no problem with people self-publishing. If it works, it works. Great. But I think that there is some folly in assuming that being published by an independent publisher or small press, especially one of the more notable ones, is somehow a failing of the author or a guaranteed death sentence of a literary career.
Well, especially when not so many years ago, the idea of self-publishing was I couldn't make it as an author trying to get an agent or find a publishing house, and so I had to do it myself.
Right. And in some cases, that is true. And people have written a great book and it just, for whatever reason, didn't connect with an agent or a publisher. And in other cases, it's just a shortcut with a poor product to get it to market.
Right. Here's my NaNoWriMo novel, and right. I don't want to wait around to get it polished. Yeah.
Exactly. Edit? Why the hell would I edit? I can put it up on, I can sell it right now.
Exactly.
So there's that.
When you do look at submissions, what is it you're looking for? Is there a je ne sais quoi?
There is a je ne sais quoi.
to get fancy on cover.
Yes. It is reflected immediately. This is kind of probably a little bit disappointing to hear for some people, but I really make up my mind in the first 5 or 10 pages whether or not I'm going to continue reading. And I know that people say, yeah, but my book is great and it really picks up in the middle or it's got a great plot twist. I won't know. And it's simply a matter of the time that I have. I need to see immediately how a book grabs me. And when you see an author firing on all cylinders, you recognize it. What that means for different editors and different publishers is going to be different. But when you see the thing that works for you, whether it be something that you personally love or something you just know would resonate with others, you know it when you see it. It's there. And the story that I like to tell is that with Scott O'Connor's Untouchable, and that's the book that won the Barnes & Noble Discover Award and it got a beautiful review in the New York Times. I called his agent after reading the first paragraph or two paragraphs and said that I wanted to acquire it.
Wow.
Just knew. And he can say those kinds of things and then produce a shit book and, you know, it's not quite as cool, but to have that book. And to be very clear, Allison did a lot of editing on the book and worked with the author to make it into what actually got the New York Times review and what actually won the Discover Award. But it was evident and clear from jump. Here is an author who's got a beautiful command of language, is pacing a story, even in a paragraph or two paragraphs, is pacing a story in a way that's going to be great. And you just know. You just know.
So there is that gut feeling you have to have about a book.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
And then do you find that your authors then come back with their second or third books? Are you in it for the long haul?
With the case in that particular book, after it won the Discover Award, I told his agent, don't come back to me. Go get money from a big house because the author, Scott, his stock was at a high point. And I'm in it for the long haul, and I certainly have loved being a part of the starting and sustaining of literary careers. But whenever I see someone who has an opportunity to move on to a big publisher, I take great pride in that. I don't ever want to hamstring those people, and I certainly feel no ill will for people going and taking advantage of bigger opportunities. And maybe it'll work for them and maybe it won't. Like you mentioned Reed Farrell Coleman earlier. Reed was not a New York Times bestselling author when I was publishing him. And then he got an opportunity to continue Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone series and write his own books, write Reed's own books for Penguin. And then he became a New York Times bestseller. I am proud. I am proud to have been a part of keeping Reed's publishing career going for a decade. I'm proud of all of that. And whatever contribution, no matter how small, I had in Reed's current success, love it. Love that. I don't mind looking at myself as a minor league baseball team that is helping to get people to the majors. Don't mind that at all.
That's great. Now, how important is an author platform to you when you're taking on an author or a book? Because I see that a lot lately, that an author needs to have a ton of followers on Twitter, or they need to be they have to have a huge blog following or something. Is that important to you when you're acquiring a book?
This is the thing that causes me the most consternation in the publishing industry. And it doesn't mean anything to me.
Okay.
It means nothing to me. However, it means something to my boss. It means something to the sales department. It means something to the publicity department. I have a problem with that process of how important an author platform should be factored into editorial considerations and acquisition considerations, it doesn't mean anything to me. And I think that it is both a system that can be gamed. We know that people buy Twitter followers or Facebook likes. We know that there are people who inflate blog traffic. We know that there are people who inflate the relevancy of any kind of accreditation, awards, any of that stuff. It doesn't mean anything to me. And further, I have a hard time finding one-to-one provable evidence that any of those things move the sales needle in any sort of convincing and overwhelming way on any kind of consistent basis. I just don't see it. I've seen authors who have no social media presence sell 10,000, 20,000 copies of a book, and I've seen authors who have larger social media presence drop like a rock and not really do anything. And because I have access to BookScan, the publishing industry's record of note for weekly book sales by title, and it's reflective of, they say, anywhere between 40 to 60% of the actual sales, because only certain bookstores are reporting. But because I have access to that, I can look and see the person who's really popular on social media, who's got a lot of people commenting on their Facebook posts or a lot of interaction on Twitter. I can look and see that that person isn't selling a lot of books. And I know that people are aspirational for that same kind of following and the understanding that it's going to sell books. And then I can see that it's not really moving the needle that way. And in the same way that in 2008 and 2009, people were screaming about ebooks are here to kill print books and this whole industry is going to crater and everything's wrong, I think that there's a little bit of that going on right now with social media and platform and the, oh my God, we have to have this situation or else we'll never sell a book. I think it's an overreactive, non-evidentiary argument that is really quite disappointing to me to really have it be. I mean, obviously it's a part of the consideration, but I think it's weighted way too much based on my experiences and my vision of how things are, which could very well not be a correct one, but just right where I am.
I mean, I've seen agency websites for submissions, and one in particular, I don't remember who it was, but I didn't query them. But one of the boxes on their form was, how do you plan on marketing this book? And I sat there going, well, isn't that what you're for? Like, why do I have to come up with a marketing plan for the book? Isn't that what you or the publisher are supposed to do? And then in terms of the social media, what I see all the time, and I don't know how this works if it works at all, but you'll see the people who all they tweet are, you know, 99 cents on Kindle today, buy my book, or, you know, my book is free today, here's the link. I can't imagine any of that actually works for long periods of time.
No.
And like you were talking about before with the people who inflate followers, you can buy followers. I've seen people who follow 17,000 people just so they can get the 17,000 follow back.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
If your platform is all gamed, you have maybe a fraction of a following who might give a crap about what you have to sell. You know, I know with my following, I have a meager following on my personal account of 1,200 people, but I know.
But they're quality people.
Exactly. I know when I put an episode out, I'm going to sell a few copies of the guest book. And I've heard that. That's fantastic. That's what I'm doing this for, is to learn and to sell, you know, good books to readers. So the quality of the following is everything. The fact that you have 150,000 followers, most of whom are bots and just followbacks, that doesn't mean anything.
Right. Exactly. I agree 100%.
On the line of querying, do you have any query or pitching horror stories?
The old standard that I go by, yes. I mean, I've had a lot of not right for me and a lot of awkward ones, and and you get things like, in the early days, you want to respond to everybody personally and you want to soften whatever blow might come with rejection. And, you know, no one on this side of the desk enjoys rejecting people. Right. No one has ever been like, oh man, my self-esteem is poor, but I bet you I can feel better about myself if I just reject a bunch of people today. Like that. And if those people do exist and they're listening to this, get the hell out of the business. But like, no one feels good about that. But there are times that get you a little bit jaded because you try to approach it as a human to human thing and you reject somebody, and then you'll get a response. It'll say something like, you're a moron, you don't understand, you'll see, I'm going to be a New York Times bestseller. That's
right. You'll rue the day you didn't publish my 7-part space opera.
Exactly. But the sort of apocryphal story for me goes back all the way to the days of Bleak House. And I was sitting down to lunch and I was opening up queries, and I got a big manila envelope that had a big lump in it. And I was reading the letter and it said, you know, here's my book, or here's the book that I want to pitch you. And I've also given you a present. I hope that it helps. I hope you enjoy it. And so there's this big wad of paper towel inside this envelope. And I was like, all right, so I'm eating. And I unwrap the paper towel, and it's a raccoon skull. Yeah. And I was like, who thinks this is a good idea? Like, yes, you've wooed me. You've wooed me so well because you gave me a raccoon skull. And that's been the extent of the weirdest thing. I've had people back at the old Bleak House office, people show up at the office, people making semi-salacious propositions about, well, you know, maybe you should consider my manuscript a little bit more. And it's like, no, that's not how any of this works. Like, no matter what gift or offering of services or any of that stuff that might pop up, I still have to be able to sell the book. Like, none of that's going to make any difference in whether or not I can sell the book. And ultimately, that's the thing that I have to care about the most. And I realize that there are certainly, and Hollywood has made a history of it, and so has the music industry. So I'll assume the publishing industry has done the same, that there have been all kinds of skeezy people who will take advantage of their position. And
yes. And they're all being played by Paul Giamatti.
but in my own experience, like, that's pretty far away from who I am as a human being and very far away from who I am as a business person.
God, it's not, has anybody gotten so far as to say, you know, it's a nice publishing house you got here. Be ashamed if anything happened to it.
No, but I'd probably hand them the gas and say, yeah, go for it. Like, let me collect the insurance and I'll be out.
That's great. You said you had a podcast too, right?
Yeah, I do a podcast. I haven't done an episode in probably about a month, called The Series of Special Guests. And I am bringing in authors and musicians and other people who I find fascinating. I've been very fortunate, both just in my personal life, but also because of publishing, that I've been able to travel to a lot of places and meet a lot of very interesting and fascinating people. And there are times where I find myself having conversations with them and saying, you know, I really wish that I could have this conversation, or that other people could hear this person talking and this person telling their story. So I've been trying to give those people a microphone where I can and introduce them to whatever meager, larger audience I'm able to whip together. But it's, you know, I'm very impressed and proud of you for what you do. And I think that technology has allowed us an opportunity to have these amazing conversations and these amazing exchanges of ideas and to get them out to a wider market. And technology has also given everybody a microphone, and sometimes we see that maybe that's not the best thing. Right now, the public square is on fire, and it is crazy and all of that. But when it's done in a certain way, and I would say that you are one of the people who is doing it in that way, it's such a beautiful thing to be able to exchange ideas and to have these conversations and affirm that we're all human and that we've all got these interests and these fascinations. And if I had and maybe you share this, if I have my druthers, I think I would just kind of have conversations and podcasts with people, you know, 12 hours a day, just to kind of bring everybody together. There's definitely a part of me that's very invested in publishing, but there's even more of me that's invested in making the world a better place by opening up dialogue between people who wouldn't otherwise have conversations. And I think that's so critical, and I think that's so important. And I hope to be able to keep building my podcast in a way that allows me an opportunity to be a part of the good that I would like to see in the world.
Well, thank you for the kind words. That's,
sure.
I really appreciate it. And I do share your sentiments. You know, Twitter for me it's a double-edged sword. It's necessary to build the audience I need for the podcast, and even to find guests for the podcast. I find 95% of my guests just by asking them on Twitter, hey, would you mind coming on? But at the same time, especially with book Twitter lately, I just want to walk away. I don't ever want to see it again. It's become, you know, every day there's someone new in the stocks to throw tomatoes at, and I just can't keep watching it happen day after day.
There's this race of people all running to the stocks, like you're saying, to throw tomatoes. And there are these purity tests that go on where, you know, if you are outraged about these five things, we're on the same team. But if you're not also outraged about six and seven to the same level that I'm outraged about it, then you are no longer part of the team.
Right.
And then someone else comes along who's even more outraged. And in one of the books that I am proudest of having published, and I will also say that with the caveat that if I were to publish it again, I might do some things differently about it. But Nathan Singer's debut novel, A Prayer for Dawn, he has a section in there talking about outrage and people being more outraged and then being outraged by those who are more outraged. And there's this whole long segment in the book. And it was so prescient 12 years ago mm-hmm. to where we are now that there's this challenge to see who can be the angriest about the most amount of things, and very often not offering any solutions, not offering any fixes. It's just, you know, I spy with my little eye one more thing to be really pissed off about.
Right.
And at some point we have to say, okay, well, I don't know that I can solve everything, but I'm going to try to solve the things that are closest to me and, you know, use a more positive energy to try to affect change in the world around me. And that is by no means, just so I'm absolutely 100% clear, that is in no way me trying to discount the legitimacy of anybody's anger about what it is they're talking about. Like, I, you know, and that's on a case by case basis. I might disagree greatly with why somebody is angry, but I'm not trying to delegitimize the anger. I'm not trying to, you know, placate them by saying things like, well, I'm just trying to be more positive. But I just know that for me, you can turn into a ball of rage and anger, and you can burn to the ground, and that might affect some of the change that you're looking for in a controlled way or an uncontrolled way. I try to be angry where I feel like it suits me, which is just, again, it's going to be different for everybody. So I'm not afraid of anger. I'm not afraid of raising my voice or a middle finger. I'm not afraid of any of that. But like one of the more significant moments in my life over the course of the last few years is I had a friend who killed himself in late 2013.
Ugh,
and when he died, he left a 42-page suicide note where he explained how he was just kind of done with this world and this life. And one of the things that he was talking about was the challenges that come with trying to live in what is often a sick society, as far as, you know, our penchant for consumerism and greed and military hostility and whatever, trying to live in that society and still be centered and still be happy and still be content and still be positive, and how you can go out into the world to try to help people, but you also have to find a way to pay the bills. So we end up pushing buttons and doing things all day long that we don't really feel good about, and we're not living our life the way that we know that we're supposed to be living it. And he wrote that in his suicide note, and I took that as a challenge. And so instead of, you know, I was upset. I was never angry with him. I was upset, of course, but the way that I dealt with that was to say, okay, I'm going to prove you wrong. He's dead, and there's nothing I can really do about that, but I'm going to prove him wrong that you can't work a 9-to-5 and still affect positive change on a regular basis. So I resolved that in 2014, I was going to do volunteer work in all 50 states.
Awesome.
And so I did volunteer work in all 50 states, and I worked with, and I kept my 9-to-5 at Tyrus, or my, you know, 8-to-6 or whatever it ends up being. But I did that, and then knowing that part of what he was talking about and railing against was just the fractured ways that we communicate with others, especially the others outside of who we are or our comfort zone. You know, I made a point of volunteering and helping and working with people who were very unlike me, and putting myself in places where I was uncomfortable and putting myself outside of my comfort zone to try to make a difference. And you realize that once you get past people trying to sell themselves as a certain thing, or, you know, people calm down long enough to not be angry because now they actually legitimately feel like they're being heard, you can make a lot more difference. And we need to be bridges. We need to be communicators, and we need to be healers in the way that we have conversations with people. And that's why, again, like what you're doing and what other people are doing with podcasts and having these conversations and expanding not just their listeners' concept of what's going on in the world, but their own concept of what's going on in the world. Like that is how we'll make it through to the other side.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I couldn't imagine a better way to end this conversation with you. Ben, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Harry.
Where can people find you?
They can check me out and get links to everything that they might need to know at BenjaminLeroy.com. And on Twitter, I've got the Tyrus Books, at Tyrus Books. But then I also have my personal Twitter, which is adventure_till, T-I-L underscore D-T-H. I think that could be wrong, but they'll find me if they want to.
I'll put everything in the show notes, so don't worry about it.
You're a good man, because my memory is failing me. But I'm always available if people have questions that they want answered about Tyrus specifically, or me specifically, or publishing in general. Whereas I might be able to offer any kind of discussion or clarity on anything, they should feel free to send those questions on Twitter, and I will do my best to address them. I am very much about the open exchange, obviously, of ideas, and trying to get a level of clarity and an openness about how decisions are made in publishing, or how publishing works. I realize that it's before social media, it was an area very closed off and a gated community, and I am all about blowing up those gates and being transparent when possible.
This has been Covered with special guest Ben Leroy of Tyrus Books. Links to Tyrus Books titles and all other titles and articles discussed on the episode today will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. In an effort to support local independent bookstores, these links, where possible, will take you to the website for Short Stories Community Book Hub, a wonderful independent bookstore located in Madison, New Jersey. Please support independent bookstores by purchasing today's titles from Short Stories or any other independent bookstore near you. Thank you for listening. If you like today's show, please take a few minutes to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes so other book lovers can better find us. We're on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We also have a Patreon page at patreon.com/covered so fans can contribute to the show's growth. Please support Covered with any amount you can. And you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. Proceeds will go towards covering bandwidth, hosting costs, and equipment upgrades. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our beautiful logo and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to FeedPress and Noct Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.